This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Hewitt. Coming up, in Vanuatu, a controversial American pharmaceutical company has been given an exclusive 25-year deal to be sole provider of a national diabetes treatment.
All I know is that it's a quite strong anti-inflammatory drug, and inflammation is one of the major drivers for diabetes. It should work, but in comparison to existing drugs, I cannot say.
3 years after shots were fired at anti-government protesters on the UPNG campus, one of the student leaders at the time is calling on the new Merape government in Papua New Guinea to order a commission of inquiry.
Let justice prevail. Let us all find out. And let us all tell this nation, 8 million people, that democracy is not dead.
And professional soccer is on its way to the Pacific at last.
PNG, Vanuatu and Fiji are looking at 2021 to go professional. That is in the radar of OFC right now.
More from John Caponato, Executive Council Member with the Oceania Football Confederation, to come later in the programme. But first to Samoa, which has made world headlines this week after the movie Rocket Man was banned from the country's only cinema. The principal censor in Apia says the biopic about the British rock star Elton John contains too many gay sex scenes and is not suitable for a Samoan audience. The local community are voicing their frustration over the ban, and as Jordan Fennell reports, one prominent LGBTQI advocate says the principal censor has way too much power.
Dad is a fat boy from nowhere. Get to be a soul man.
The Apollo Cinema in Apia had Rocket Man listed for screening up until Friday last week, when they posted on Facebook that due to censorship issues, they had to cancel the showing. There was an outcry from locals on social media who had been waiting to see the film about the British pop star.
People don't pay to see Reg White. They pay to see Elton John.
Enric Sitanale, a university student at the National University of Samoa, says he believes they censored the movie due to its references to Elton John's homosexual relationships.
Well, this isn't the first time that a movie like this has been censored here. A few years ago, they censored a movie called Milk. So that movie was about gay rights. Another movie that they banned screening was The Da Vinci Code because it went against religious belief here. You know, the general train of thought is that the reason why they chose to censor this movie was because of Elton John's homosexuality.
Under Samoa's film classification guide, films that include explicit sexual activity, explicit sexual violence, promotion of drugs, or offence to religions are subject to bans. Enric says if these guidelines were followed, lots of other movies would get banned, but they don't.
They allowed the screening of movies like John Wick. They had no, they still allowed kids under 12 to watch the movie. And the movie's ridiculously violent. And they also allowed the screening of Red Sparrow, which that movie was pretty intense as well.
It's a thought echoed by Alex Sua, the president of the Samoa Fafafine Association and prominent LGBTIQ activist.
It's very general. It's not very particular about it mustn't have homosexual scenes, or it can capture any movie, even a slight violence should be then censored. But that's not always the case. Very general. But I think even in the legislation as well, the powers given to the principal censor to make a decision on it is just too powerful. That he or she, whatever she or he feels, in his opinion, it doesn't really meet what these criteria of what the Film Act says. Because I still come across movies at the DVD shop as highly violent, yet it manages to find its way through the principal censors.
Alex Sua says banning the movie deprives Samoa's LGBTIQ community of seeing someone who shares their struggles represented on the screen.
The LGBTI movement started off with the struggles, and I think Elton John's movie, The Rocket Man, is all about someone who struggled to come out of being himself and eventually found himself.
In Samoa, homosexuality is illegal between men with a penalty of up to 5 years in prison. However, that does not apply to women, and there is also wide acceptance of whawhawhine, which is a recognized third gender in Samoan culture that applies to people assigned male at birth but display feminine qualities. Alex says despite this, there is a general lack of understanding from the public about LGBTIQ issues.
If you talk to people about whawhawhine and whasama, they click. And they say, oh, that's no problem. But if you talk to them about LGBTI, they get very confused.
According to the United Nations 2016 Pacific Multicountry Mapping and Behavioural Study, there are estimated to be between 25,000 to 30,000 men who sleep with other men in Samoa, which is roughly 15% of Samoa's total population. But Alex says because of the country's deep religious beliefs, LGBTIQ issues are not talked about and that they face significant challenges.
The trans healthcare, there's no framework for our community as far as that is concerned. We're still seeing from institutional discrimination, and we've seen that here with as well with the principal censor decision on the Rocket Man movie.
But despite the ban, a cinema is not the only way to catch a movie, and Alex says he plans to source it online.
Jordan Fennell with that report. A pharmaceutical company that's been mired in controversy has signed an exclusive agreement with the Vanuatu government, locking it in as sole provider of a national diabetes treatment for the next 25 years. The company, Phoenix Life Sciences, is also planning to develop a marijuana plantation on the island of Santo and offer its cannabis-based medication to diabetics as an alternative to insulin. But as Priyanka Srinivasan reports, news of the deal has provoked outrage in some quarters, and protesters are planning to petition the government to tear up the contract.
In Vanuatu, diabetes is the largest cost to the national healthcare system.
Ever since pharmaceutical company Phoenix Life Sciences announced plans to relocate its operations from the United States to Vanuatu, there has been a flurry of activity. The company has set up so-called health centers to provide medical tests to patients and recruited people for planned clinical trials of its cannabis-based drugs. And now Phoenix Life Sciences has signed the agreement, giving it exclusive rights to offer medical services for diabetes, cervical cancer, and autoimmune disease. The company has also been granted rights to prescribe its product, Phoenix Metabolic, which contains the marijuana-derived cannabinoids, as an alternative to insulin for diabetics. But a Ministry of Health spokesperson says Phoenix Life Sciences can't begin operations until changes are made to the country's Dangerous Drugs Act. Jimmy Luna Tesong is an assistant to Vanuatu's Minister of Health.
In Vanuatu, we have acted to prohibit the illegal drugs. We cannot start anything else like what they are trying to do in Vanuatu unless the act is amended. Till such time when the act is amended, we can talk about the right to Phoenix Life Science to carry out their duties.
Nevertheless, CEO Martin Tindall says the company is moving forward with its program and is continuing its clinical trials on diabetes patients. He says the company will always operate under Vanuatu's laws and its signed agreements. But the announcement has shocked locals on the island of Santo, where, according to the agreement, Phoenix Life Sciences will be provided 5,000 acres of land to set up a marijuana plantation. Graeme Lele is a customary chief of Araki Island in South Santo, where the plantation would be located. He believes the agreement is fraudulent.
Under the laws of Vanuatu, marijuana is an illegal drug. And how the government come to accept the company's proposal and all the ideas behind that is what we can say is fraudulent or still in the question. Because many people in Vanuatu, I believe, they are against the idea, and especially the people in Santo are fully against the idea.
Chief Lele is particularly concerned about the health impacts of the treatment offered by Phoenix Life Sciences.
We are worried. Our people are worried. The general population of Santo and South Santo are worried, especially for the youth and young people, at how we're going to approach that after the approval of the government through the Council of Chiefs and Santo. They'll petition the government and not to establish the company.
Phoenix Life Sciences claims that its product, Phoenix Metabolic, that uses compounds extracted from the cannabis plant, is an effective treatment for diabetes. But the World Health Organization doesn't recommend cannabis as a treatment for diabetes. Ryu Chukwuchi from Australia's Curtin University is currently researching the benefits of cannabis for treating memory loss in diabetics. He says there are indications the drug could be helpful in treating diabetes, though he's not sure it would be better than existing treatments.
If the US company is actually doing such research, I actually don't know how this is going to be effective. All I know is that it's a quite strong anti-inflammatory drug, and inflammation is one of the major drivers for diabetes. It should work, but in comparison to like existing drugs like glitazone and metformin, I cannot say.
Vanuatu's Doctors Association is also worried by developments, saying Vanuatu doesn't have the adequate ethics oversight to ensure the trials are conducted safely. Phoenix Life Science is expected to respond to these concerns in the coming days.
Priyanka Srinivasan reporting. I'm Richard Hewitt, and you're listening to Pacific Review. The student leader at the heart of the anti-government protests in Papua New Guinea 3 years ago is calling on the Marape government to order a commission of inquiry into the events of June 2016 when shots were fired on the UPNG campus. It's understood that inquiries by both the police and the university were completed, but no overarching government investigation and no findings of any sort have ever been made public. But now Prime Minister James Marape and his newly appointed Police Minister Brian Kramer are under pressure to establish the facts and find out who was responsible for the pandemonium at UPNG that could easily have led to fatalities. By June of 2016, the UPNG students had been campaigning for many weeks and demanding the resignation of Prime Minister Peter O'Neill, who was being persistently linked with corruption allegations. The president of the Students' Association at that time, Kenneth Rapper, says they were urging Mr. O'Neill to step aside and clear his name for the sake of the integrity of the highest office in the land.
We were addressing the issues of Paragasaga as well as the UPS loan. We knew that there was a lot of things that were not right. What we were doing was we were only telling him that the office of the Prime Minister was bigger than him or anyone on that matter, and it cannot be tainted by one man's action.
But Mr. O'Neill refused to bow to public pressure, and matters came to a head when the students attempted to march on Parliament. As the security forces tried to prevent that from happening, NBC journalist Rose Amos says all hell broke loose.
I was among the crowd between the police and the students, and someone decided to pull the trigger, and many students, males, females, were injured at the time. I was one of the journalists who was fetched up by police. It was a terrified moment for me, and I was very shaken, and I cried that time. I ran into one of the vehicles. I don't know which vehicle I went, and later I found that it was one of the police vehicles I ran into, and I was rescued by a very good police officer. I am still thankful for that person.
As word got round of what had happened, opposition MPs in Parliament claimed erroneously that there had been fatalities. There were none, but a number of students had certainly been injured, and Kenneth Rapper says the events of that day have left a lasting impression.
Not only physically, but psychologically, emotionally, it has really, really put a burden on most of the students, and former students as well, now graduates. And we feel and we know that at least we voiced something that no one wanted to say anything. At least we said something that when no one wanted to say something. At least we stood up when no one wanted to stand up against a government that was controlling everything.
But 3 years on, there is still no definitive account of what happened on the UPNG campus, with a spokesman for the university telling Pacific Beat no shots were fired and suggesting that the whole event has been misreported. Such a claim flies in the face of the popular view, and Rose Amos wants the facts to come out, and she says it's up to the self-styled corruption-busting police minister, Brian Kramer, to deliver.
As a citizen and as someone who has been a victim on that day, I am still seeking for justice to prevail. And as a journalist, I believe with the new government, that is one of my tasks. I would like to ask the new government about this investigation. And Brian Kramer, now that you're police minister, I will also put to him whether he will go back and check on that investigation. That's a question I will put to him.
Kenneth Rapper says the students echo those sentiments and on the anniversary of the shooting have written to the new Prime Minister, James Marape, urging him, albeit belatedly, to act.
In my view, the only request that we can put through is they can put through a commission of inquiry to the shooting and let justice prevail. Let us all find out and let us all tell this nation, the 8 million people, that democracy is not dead. It's still alive and justice can be served to people who doesn't follow horses and abuse power.
So far, Minister Cramer has not responded to Pacific Beat's request for an interview about his intentions on such a sensitive matter. But Rose Amos says the fact that he's in office at all is a victory for the students, albeit a little late, and one that Kenneth Rapper is right to take pride in.
The students fought. They fought for their country. And I guess what they fought for has eventually led up to what we've seen with the change of government.
I'm very proud of my students, and I still believe that it was one front of a battle for war against corruption, and we still have a long way to go, but give an opportunity to every citizen of this country to let them dream what they want to dream of. And that is the truth and vibrant democracy that our country needs.
Kenneth Rapper, president of the UPNG Students Association back in 2016, who incidentally is also calling for the reinstatement with full powers of all the student representative councils in PNG's tertiary institutions. Next to Solomon Islands, where the diplomatic wrangling over the country's support for Taiwan is gathering momentum. The big question for the new government of Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare is, do they stick with the long-time ally that has brought economic benefits to the country, or switch their allegiance to China with the promise of even greater benefits under the Belt and Road Trade Initiative? As Stephen Jedgetts reports, opinions are starkly divided and the decision-making process is being played out against a background of the ongoing trade war between China and the United States.
A piggery isn't usually a tool of soft power. But this is no normal piggery. It sits in the middle of a neat little farm on the outskirts of Honiara and is one of the flagship development projects run and paid for by the government of Taiwan. The farm provides cut-price piglets to local farmers, and Taiwan's deputy ambassador to Solomon Islands, Oliver Liao, says that's not all.
They have managed to bring quite a variety of vegetables and fruit to Solomon Island.
Solomon Islands is one of six Pacific Island nations which still recognises Taiwan, and Taipei pours millions of dollars into aid programs like this to keep it on board. But Oliver Liao says this peaceful equilibrium is being disrupted.
The PRC has been taking every possible measure to force Taiwan into reunification with them. They are hoping to make Taiwan disappear.
China wants to isolate Taiwan diplomatically, and Beijing-backed businesses have made overtures to the Solomon Islands government. Some MPs are now pressing new Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare to ditch Taiwan and embrace China instead. And Mr. Sogavare is weighing the decision carefully.
And we are under a lot of pressure to rethink this relationship.
The tide of history might be against Taiwan. Solomon Islands remains mired in poverty, and former Prime Minister Gordon Darcy Lilo says if Solomon Islands recognises Beijing, then investment might boom.
What is it wrong for this country to consider the opportunities that can come out from a China that is a reform China, and a China that can offer a better economic opportunity?
Others are horrified by the rush. Opposition leader Matthew Wale accuses some MPs of taking a mercenary approach.
There's been no discussion about what are our national interests, what are we trying to achieve, what are we looking for. Are we just looking for more money? At the moment, it seems that's the driving force.
Some fear an influx of Chinese cash would also stoke rampant development, fostering corruption and damaging the environment. And the broader geopolitical arm wrestle between the US and China looms over this debate. The US and Taiwan accused China of lending huge sums to several small island nations before using that debt as leverage. Oliver Liao has a coded warning for Australia.
A strong, independent and sovereign Solomon Island is not only in the interest of Solomon Island itself, but it's also in the interest of other countries such as Australia.
Taiwan faces its own accusations of fostering corruption. Critics say the so-called constituency funds it pays to local MPs are often pocketed by elites or frittered away. Prominent journalist Alfred Sasako believes Honiara is capable of negotiating a better deal with China.
Okay, the loans may be bad, But in exchange for the loan, we got good roads, good airports.
Manasseh Sogavare admits the choice is weighing on him.
And we need help here to help us to make a decision that will not affect the peace.
But in the end, this is a decision Solomon Islands must make for itself.
Stephen Jedgetts reporting from Honiara, and you're listening to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. Finally this week, the first professional soccer leagues in the Pacific could kick off in just 2 years' time under an ambitious plan signed off by the Oceania Football Confederation. And OFC also wants to set up a new international tournament that would do much to deal with the biggest complaint from soccer-playing nations in the Pacific, the shortage of meaningful matches. When the FIFA World Cup expands to 48 teams in 2026, the hope is that one of that number will be from the Pacific Islands, and the OFC's blueprint is built around achieving that aim.
The increased FIFA World Cup places offered to Oceania have broadened OFC's scope for strategic planning.
Part of that planning will involve establishing an OFC Nations League, similar to those that have already proved successful in Europe and in North and Central America. OFC Executive Council member and president of the PNG FA, John Caponato, says the money for such an ambitious project is there.
I think for little countries around the Oceania, I think we have FIFA funding that supports on our international matches that we go out and play. So financially, I think they're catered for this kind of matches.
As national coach in Fiji, Christophe Gomel already has a program in place that has seen the senior men's team, the Bulla Boys, play a series of friendly internationals in the Pacific and in Asia. And while he says he would be 200% behind the Nations League concept, he also has a proposal of his own.
The six best Oceanian nations, a small tournament between them. After that, we request to be invited to a tournament like in Asia, the Hyundai Cup, or in South America, or in Europe. And then we are able to have much more international games, and we will lift up the level to be efficient for who will be qualified for the World Cup.
But while any new international competition would certainly boost Oceania's prospects, a much more significant step would be the creation of professional leagues. And John Caponato says that vision is set to become a reality.
PNG, Vanuatu and Fiji are looking at 2021 to go professional. That is in the radar of OFC right now. OFC is setting up a new marketing department, and they're going to be working closely with Papua New Guinea, Vanuatu and Fiji to set up a professional league.
Christophe Gomel is right behind the plan, but adds a word of caution.
Actually, I think it will be more semi-professional than professional. It will be the middle step before really reaching the professional step, because when you create a pro club, you have a compulsory things to do. So some academy, it's about structure, it's about administration, but it takes time.
Gomel believes a pro league of no more than 8 teams can be sustained, and that's exactly the line PNG are taking with plans for a pilot Tier 1 competition to start next season. And John Caponato says sponsors are lining up.
Right now we have a major sponsor who is supporting the NSL, Kumu Petroleum Holdings, and we've got a 2-year sponsorship with them. So we're really trying to discuss with them on a way forward on a Tier 1 so that they see that we're bringing football in Papua New Guinea to a next level of professional.
While there is excitement about the idea of pro leagues in Oceania, there is also a sense of realism in terms of what those professional players will earn.
We would shoot it to our country's ceiling of contracts, something that is able to sustain them in this country. I mean, it's a challenge there. We've got 2 years to attract business partners to come in to ride on what we're trying to do. One of the good things also, we have a television now, MTV now is very interested in coming on board to support us.
And as ever in the Pacific, if the pro leagues and a new international competition are to succeed, supporters like John Caponato and Christophe Gomel will have to fight off the entrenched views of the old guard.
They are trying to break the work that we, with the federation, we are trying to do. I don't know why some people want to break this process, because it is amazing to see an Oceanian country go to the World Cup. It's my mission. I will continue what I think is the best for Fijian soccer.
OFC's vision is driven by our determination of leaving a lasting legacy and increasing the competitiveness of our member associations at both OFC competitions and FIFA World Cups.
OFC, nothing if not ambitious for the future of soccer in the Pacific. And that's it from this edition of Pacific Review. If you'd like to listen to your news from the region on demand, you can do that by subscribing to our podcast. I'm Richard Ewart, and as always, thank you very much for listening.